Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
This episode is in partnership with Mountain Valley Spring Water. It's one of our favorite water companies. We serve it at our events and we seek it out when we are at the grocery store. We get it delivered at home. We have a great deal going on with them throughout the end of May. If you go to pineapplemountainvalley.com, you can get 40% off 3 months of home delivery. That's $85 for 6 cases of water. Get it.
Full Service Radio.
You're listening to Pineapple Radio on Full Service Radio, broadcasting from the Line Hotel in Washington, D.C. I'm one of your hosts, Atara.
And I'm your other host, Arielle. And we are the founders of Pineapple Collaborative, which is a community of over 100,000 women who love food, which is very exciting because we also love food.
Oh, yes. And if you've been listening to the podcast, you're probably familiar with what we do. We have digital content from our blog to our newsletter, our Instagram, and this radio show. We have events in D.C., New York, San Francisco, and newly launched in L.A., which we're so excited about.
Yeah, we just came back from L.A. last week, and while we were there, we hosted 3 launch events in 24 hours, which was insanity, but also the best kind.
We did it, guys.
Because we got to meet so many incredible, not only leaders from throughout the L.A. food industry, but also women who love food. We did an event at the Line Hotel in Koreatown in Los Angeles, which was super fun. And it was actually a live broadcast party of recording this podcast. So if you're listening to this episode, check out the one before, which is our season premiere, Rise and Shine, with the Women Defining Breakfast Culture in L.A.
Yeah, and I think, you know, coming back from L.A., feeling so inspired by the women and the food culture there is a great segue for this show. We are so excited to have our friend Camilla Marcus in the studio with us. Hi, Camilla.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, oh, now we go.
There we go.
You have to make out with the mic.
Yes, yes. So we're going to introduce Camilla in just a minute and talk all about how she's been inspired by the West Coast and in her life and business and beyond. Before we do that, Arielle and I are going to check in with each other. We haven't done this segment in a while, but we are firm believers that our kitchens and food in general is how we express ourselves, from our style, our identity, and our values and beyond. And so what we like to do is talk to each other about all the things we pine for in the world of food and women, especially in our kitchens. So Arielle, what have you been into lately?
Yeah, so speaking of LA, there's an incredible confectionery base there called Valerie. And you may know the name, but if you've been to LA, you probably recognize her gorgeous chocolate bars. And they're designed in the most beautiful way. And they're all different because she does insane collaborations with other food folks, as well as, you know, designers and fashion and so much more. So when we were out in LA, I got to try the My Dreams Are Electric chocolate bar, which is a collaboration between Valerie Confections and Edible Gardens LA. And it had, it was bittersweet chocolate speckled with bee pollen.
Ooh, yum. She also is like the sweetest woman. We are so excited we got to hang with her. So check out Valerie Chocolates.
Confectionery.
Valerie Confectionery.
Confections, actually. Anyway, Atara, what is yours?
Yeah, so before Arielle and I went out to LA to launch our outpost there, we got some nice chill friend time and we spent 3 days in Joshua Tree, which was so fun and relaxing and really like set the stage for what was to come. We got to hike and we ate delicious food, we cooked together, and we got to meet up with someone we admire in the food industry, Allison Carroll of Wonder Valley Olive Oil. She has a showroom out in Joshua Tree called The Oil Shop, where she displays all of her oils and beautiful merchandise as well. But her olive oil is simply delicious. It's like spicy and herbaceous and well-rounded. We loved meeting her, and her oil is delicious, and you can get it at wondervalley.com.
Cool. Well, now to our episode, because it has influence of California, but so much more. And we're so lucky to have Camilla down here with us in D.C. for the day. We're currently, there's a photo shoot outside of us right now, so that's a bit distracting. But in any case, Camilla, before we get into her formal bio, it's seriously an honor to be here because we had the opportunity to meet her about 5 years ago at a Toklas Society event in New York. And, you know, since then, she's been an incredible friend and mentor and supporter, not only of Pineapple, but also business endeavors, personal endeavors that preceded Pineapple. I opened a vegetarian taco shop with a few women, and I remember creating my first pitch deck, and I was like, Camilla, will you look at it? And not only did she say yes, but the feedback she provided, I think, forever changed the course of that business for the better. And it's really having women like her in your corner, in your network, that makes this industry not only gratifying, but I think successful. It's a true inspiration for our Pine Floor philosophy, which is the idea that admiring other women, women-made products, women-powered companies, creates community. It's hugely powerful, and especially as women, we need to support each other to, you know, all achieve our goals. So thank you.
No, I'm the lucky one to get to be here in this beautiful setting at the Line Hotel in DC. And, you know, I don't know that I'm deserving of that kind of an intro. I feel just as fortunate that our paths crossed, and it's just such a joy to get to hang out.
Yeah, we have a fun day planned with Camilla. We've already been to Salu and Ellie, and we are hanging out here at the Line, which is ever inspiring. But we're so excited that you're here with us today. So, who is Camilla Marcus? I'm sure many of you know her and know her beautiful business, Westbourne. Camilla is the founder of Westbourne, which is New York's our favorite, actually, all-day cafe that we pine for. It's inspired by the creativity, the vibe of the West Coast, and she is the brain behind nourishing, inventive dishes that just so happen to be vegetarian. She's also a seasoned businesswoman and an investor who is committed to investing in other women-owned businesses that we pine for, like Ramona, The Wing, Great Jones, and the website platform Bento Box, which Westbourne is also on. She is truly just amazing, and we really pine for her commitment to launching social enterprises with a triple bottom line and bringing the creative businesses into the world that we pine for.
So, Camilla, talk to us. Tell us about yourself. How did you get into food?
So I have always really been into restaurants and food since I was young, which is funny because no one in my family really has that interest and kind of always looked at me like I was a little alien. And, you know, I always loved to cook since I was young, loved eating out. I was a really adventurous eater. Like, I was eating uni, you know, at 4 years old and, you know, much to my parents' disgust. I think for me, it just always was a way to connect to other people, you know. Gifts and quality time are kind of my love languages, and I think food really channels both of those. And I think it's also a way to really get to someone's heart, to get to understand them, to connect to a culture, to learn something new about them and yourself. So I knew I'd always wanted to go to culinary school. I went right after college. I went to the same college as Ariel, actually, Go Penn. You know, and at that time, it wasn't, like, popular. You know, people weren't going into food. I always laugh. I must be the only person, you know, one of the only people in the alumni directory that, you know, shows up for hospitality. When I told my college guidance counselor I was going to the French Culinary Institute, she was like, well, what do I put on the paper, like, to report to them? And I was like, I don't know. Then I went to culinary school, you know, and it's just was not really the path. I mean, now it's so popular, which is so interesting. But I honestly don't know. I never really had a path. I mean, I think people look in hindsight and they, you know, look at my experience and my background. And they're like, oh, it's like perfect. And, you know, Westbourne makes so much sense. I'm like, are you kidding me? Every job I had, I clawed through. Every job interview I ever had, they're like, we don't get you. Your background's too weird. You're an artist. You went to culinary school. You went to law school. You're in business. Like, who are you? This is so weird. What do we do with you? And, you know, it was really hard. I think, you know, most of my college roommates were doctors, you know, became doctors. And I always said I really envied those people. I envy chefs who know at 14 that they want to be on the line every day. I mean, I just was not gifted with a lot of things, but I just did not have that calling. And I always really envied people who did because it makes life a lot easier. I think it's a lot harder for people who are diverse in what they're interested in, are generalists in what they're capable of. And it's sort of the, you know, it's the privilege and the curse of choice and being able to almost act on anything. But the world doesn't really reward that, I think, for a really long time. And I think in your 20s, it's really hard because society really pushes you to be in a box, to be defined, to be specialized. And that just never fit me, which was always really hard. So, you know, my background on my path into food has been very circuitous and non-traditional and very weird. You know, I've done everything from host reservations to, you know, construction to business development to everything in between, to working on the line, to cooking. And, you know, even today it's interesting, you know, it does sort of to a lot of people on the outside seem like, oh, you had this path and it was perfect and it worked out and the yellow brick road, you know, led you there. And I'm like, yeah, right. I felt like I was on a crazy jungle gym with no idea what was up or down, just, you know, grabbing things. You're like, okay, just don't fall off. Or if you fall off, get back up. You know, and I think what I think about even now is there's still a lot of that specialization pressure. Like I had one press say, well, we can't list you as a chef. And I'm like, okay, well, most chefs don't cook on the line anymore. Like when mm-hmm. you own your own business, you know, you help with the creative direction, but you can't be on the line every day and negotiating a lease and working on the branding, working on growth and partnerships, et cetera. Like you can't be all those things all the time. You know, how is that different than name your favorite male executive chef or, right. you know, male restaurateur? And it's sort of like, oh, well, you invest. So are you an entrepreneur or are you an investor? And
yeah,
there's just this huge pressure to sort of be defined and in a box and something simple and easy for someone to digest, which I think I'm still kind of struggling with. Yes.
Well, it's interesting. One of the quotes that I have up on my inspiration board is don't confine yourself to your own identity, because it really allows you to be who you want to be. But I think going back to describing your food journey and your career, I would say where I sit looking at your diverse experiences that it makes so much sense that you are, you know, a really successful business owner of a restaurant, started this incredible event series Tech Table, and are also investing because it brings together your many talents and interests. So it's interesting to hear you reflect on getting to where you are today. Like, it was not a straight path. Like, you weren't like, I'm going to be this multi-hyphenate, you know, restaurateur, investor.
But see, that word didn't even exist when I graduated college.
Right.
You know, now I feel like you can sort of say anything when you're, you know, 18 years old. So much has been blown open.
Yeah.
I do think food was always sort of at the heart. I mean, I mm-hmm. always loved to cook. Loved eating out. I've always been fascinated by the business, by hotels, by restaurants, by gatherings. So I do think that was always sort of an underpinning. I think the question for me was, you know, where do I fit and where am I going to feel that I'm still challenged and how is it all going to make sense? And, you know, I kind of waffled in between there. You know, I had a stint with private equity and I worked a summer at a law firm. And, you know, there's definitely this yin-yang push-pull of, you know, I have very old school parents who are very conservative and sort of on the more traditional end. And, you know, my dad was like, why are you going to culinary school? What is this? You know, so I think, again, food now has changed. I think when you're in your 20s and you say you want to get into the food business or hospitality, there's so many more opportunities. It's seen so publicly. You know, in that time, it really wasn't. So not only is my path not a straight and narrow, to say the least, it just wasn't what people talked about. I mean, my friends thought I was a leper. Now it's like the, you know, the bee's knees to be a restaurateur. It's super cool. And you're like, what just happened? So, you know, I'm appreciative that the tide is changing. I think it makes my job just a little bit easier. But yeah, I don't know. My food journey was intuitive and unpredictable, I guess I would say.
Well, I certainly feel like, you know, having that multidimensional curiosity and education has set you up for success in so many ways, which we can talk about in just a little bit. But I'm curious about how you grew up around food. Tell me about your parents and what it was like being in your house growing up around food.
My house growing up was crowded and hectic. My grandma lived there. We had three kids, dogs. I mean, it was like way too much going on in one place, which I think is why I also love restaurants, the chaos and sort of being with people all the time. You know, I'm the youngest. I never want to be alone. I would love to live in a compound with all the people I love. That's like my all-time dream. Like everyone lives on my farm. With food, you know, it's interesting because my mom, you know, her mom died when she was really young. She never grew up cooking. In fact, like didn't even know how to boil water when she married my dad. My dad was a former military guy, so he could cook and survive, but it was like, you know, three dishes pretty well.
Yeah.
So again, food was not really at the heart, but gathering and being together. And by the time I was a kid, my oldest brother kind of put the kibosh on home eating because he was like, let's just eat out. Like it just stresses everyone. It's not that fun. It, you know, my mom is a great cook. She just doesn't really love it the way I do. And so we sort of started also eating out probably way younger than most kids are because I had two older brothers and they were like, we're over this. You know, so I was definitely raised much more in restaurant culture, probably at a young age. But my dad worked in Japan most of my childhood. So, you know, we were eating in Little Tokyo and exploring really traditional Japanese food well before it was popular. Again, now, you know, Japanese food and sushi has exploded. I mean, the fact that everyone knows what a katsu sandwich is, you know, boggles my mind now. But it was really off the beaten path to do that in Los Angeles. My mom's born and raised in LA, and you know, it was a whole new world, and I loved it. I mean, I was like the three-year-old at the sushi counter, like, try and freak me out. My family's like, we don't know where she came from. Who is she? So I do think that sort of sense of adventure with food and me being very curious about food, my parents always indulged it and supported it. You know, even today, they're so cute, though. I love doing back-to-back dinners. I do that a lot, especially when I'm traveling. I'll have, you know, 20 meals. So when I'm traveling with my mom or my mom's in town or I'm in LA, they're so sweet and they'll say, okay, what are the two dinners are we doing? Mm-hmm. You know, where are we going? And my mom knows that when she travels with me, you like, if you don't almost want to throw up at the end of the day, we have not done our job.
Yeah.
So, you know, she wouldn't normally do that and that's not really her jam. But I'm lucky to have parents that, you know, I definitely swam against the grain, but they were kind of into it and, you know, find it entertaining at least. So a little bit funny to be, you know, sort of a fish out of water when it comes to food in your own family. But, you know, LA, I think I really didn't appreciate it till, you know, I came to New York. You know, when you grow up in the heartland of where most agriculture is raised, where, you know, we were eating local organic before that was normal. Mrs. Gooch, funny enough, most people don't know who she is, but she was actually the predecessor to Whole Foods. She was one of the first organic sort of healthy grocery stores. She had a few locations in LA and she just happened to live on my street, which is like
wow,
a Malcolm Gladwell, you know, outlier situation. So, you know, my mom was very focused on health. So we were raised on a lot of these amazing products, local produce. You know, we have farmers markets in every neighborhood and they're affordable and they're amazing. I mean, not just today, but this is, you know, in the 80s when I was raised, that didn't exist anywhere else in the country. And when you grow up in that bubble, you don't realize that that's unusual. So I do think that also informs sort of my love for food and appreciation for cooking because I grew up with the best of the best ingredients without even realizing that that, you know, was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So again, a little bit of a unique kind of microcosm, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a huge inspiration for Westbourne, which you opened up about a year and a half ago now. So tell us briefly about Westbourne and what's been the most surprising thing to you now, you know, being a restaurateur, having your own place in it, seeing so much success in the last year and a half.
Yeah, so we are LA-inspired, mission-driven, vegetable-forward. It's all LA all day, same menu, 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., 7 days a week. We opened out of the gate, full days, full hours, which is totally unheard of in this business. Our mission, we are both a zero-waste restaurant. We're hopefully going to be the first certified zero-waste restaurant in Manhattan, but we are also partnered with the Robin Hood Foundation. So we donate 1% of every purchase. That means products, in-store, events and catering, delivery, you name it. When you buy it, It goes through the Robin Hood Foundation to a local organization called The Door, which is two blocks from our location. We're investing in hospitality retraining for youth in the neighborhood, and then we hire from the program. So really full cycle, fully integrated. And the goal is, you get your coffee or you grab dinner and a glass of wine, and that can really do something for a neighbor, that lives in your hood. And then Vegetable Forward, you mentioned so eloquently that, we don't sort of advertise that we're vegetarians. We don't really want to be pigeonholed. We don't want people to come in and sort of prejudge. But, our food system has to change. And part of that is how we consume. We cannot be eating animal products every day for every meal all the time the way that we do. I'm not a vegetarian. Most of our team members are not. But it is important that we eat more thoughtfully and sustainably if we want our planet that gets passed down to resemble anything of what we have today. And our hope is that we sort of trick you into it, that you leave and think, oh yeah, I didn't have meat. And it was exciting and delicious and inspired and, beautiful. And I just loved the vibe and I had a great time. That's kind of our goal. The biggest surprise, I'd say one of them is, when I look back, I never had an employee ever. I never even had an intern. I've always been sort of a SEAL Team 6 in companies for whatever reason, like a one-man band, and they're like, you don't need anyone working for you. I'm like, I could use some help.
I tried working for you. I remember that. I was like, just like hire me. I'll work for free. And you're like, this is when you were at USHG, and you were like, I'm not sure I can do that. And I was like, it's okay. I'll be there.
Trust me. I tried so hard. I was like, I would do anything for one other person. They're like, you're fine. I'm like, okay. It's one of those things where like you make do, and then you're like, why did I show that I could do that? Because now I have to do that all the time. So, really going from never even having an intern or a team to having, 30 team members was wild. And honestly, I didn't think about it at the time, but about 6 months in, I was like, man, like, I'm in charge of 30 people and they trust me and they're into it and this is working and I don't know what I'm doing and everyone seems to be okay with that. And, I think that's a really pleasant and special surprise. And I think it's the part of all of this that is one of the most rewarding. I think to get to see someone actualize their potential and challenge and excite themselves and work through tough times and roadblocks, I get just so much fulfillment and joy from developing my team, seeing them grow, sharing in all of it together, and learning myself. I think, there's no like book. I mean, I read a lot of business books and people are always like, what's your rubric? It's like, no one prepares you, you have no idea. I guess I'm probably the first two to just tell my team, like, look, I don't know. I'm very dense. You have to tell me. Something's not working. Speak up. If you've got a solution, I want to hear it. Like, I am not the end all be all. I have no clue what I'm doing. So we're in it together. But I think that's been the best and probably biggest surprise.
Well, so many questions to ask you there. And, we... Yeah, we admire so much about Westbourne. The food is amazing. The environment is amazing. The inspiration, you feel a sense of place when you walk in and you just get it. You understand where the vision comes from. It was really interesting going to Seilu Bakery and having you talk about how you had just taken this beautiful 3-week vacation to New Zealand and San Francisco. No, but that's not, to us, it's... It means so much for you to talk about your ethic of giving your team time off and how that is a very important and central ethos of your company, of your restaurant. I mean, we talk a lot about the, necessity of balance and all that that means. And I think the fact that you're setting that culture from the top is very important.
I think one of the things that always got to me was unusual. Look, I'm a very hard worker. I mean, I work 24/7. I can never shut it off. I wish sometimes I could. I really believe, work hard and be present, but then you really have to plug out. I mean, if you really are someone who's a high performer and, active in your brain and trying to be creative in whatever you're doing, wherever you fall in an organization, you have to have a break. Like, you cannot be gassed 24/7. Otherwise, that quality will not stay high. That's true for myself. Like, I get crazy antsy. Like, if I do not travel or explore a new neighborhood or do something different. Like, I'm totally afraid of routine. I'm totally afraid of everything being the same. It's ironic I've been married and with my husband so long because it's like the only form of stability in my life. I'm just very afraid of that. It really messes with sort of my mental space. And I've always known that about myself. And when I worked for other people, it was always so hard. You know, I remember towards the end of being at USHG and, you know, my husband had just started his job and we decided to go to Africa with my parents for two weeks. We both turned 30. It was our fifth anniversary. It was my mom's 65th birthday. It was the first time we'd even considered a two-week vacation in 7 years. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, I go, that is so messed up. The fact that we're having like a family meeting about whether that is okay bothers me. Like, what? I mean, the world is not going to end with us being away. And, you know, life is precious. You don't know how long you have time with your parents or things like that. And that's just so special. So I said, you know what? Like, F it. We're doing it. I don't even care. Like, if both of us get fired, we'll figure it out. But we just have to go. So, you know, when I started Westbourne, I really said to the team, look, I expect 110% commitment. I want everyone all hands on deck all times. But everyone gets vacation. Everyone, we really try hard that every manager gets 2 days off a week consecutive as much as possible. You know, when people are sick, we do not want them there. Like, it is not okay to come to work sick. We will send you home. It does not matter what your position is. And again, like, when you're gone, the goal is that the team covers you because you're going to cover them when they go. I just think, you know, American culture especially is very geared towards this, like, go, 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 never stop, never say no. And, you know, people ask me all the time, how could you leave the business? And I said, look, you also have to give trust to get trust. If people don't feel like you trust them and that they can do it too, how are they ever going to get there? And I think that vacuum also creates a lot of opportunity for people to step up and see, wow, like, I can do it. You know, all those things that person's helping me with, you know what, I actually could do it on my own. So, I don't know. I've also been told by my team, I know, no surprise because I'm an attorney, that I like the Socratic method. And I'm very much like, you know, you got to find your path down the road. You know, I'm there on the sides, but I really, because I don't like to be micromanaged. I don't like to be told what to do all the time. So I wouldn't really guide in the same way. But I do think that balance, I think restaurateurs especially, and especially chefs, there's this martyr mentality. Like, the harder I work, the most day, you know, I get so frustrated when I hear chefs or restaurateurs be like, oh, it's my 50th day, no day off. And I'm like, don't brag about that. That is not, it's actually not cool.
Yeah.
It's not cool. And it shows me that you're not actually leading. Managing means not doing it all by yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's actually, I think, harder for people to do. It's a lot easier to do it all by yourself. I can tell you, it's way harder to delegate. It is way harder to trust. It's way harder to let someone interpret what you want and do it their way and be okay with that.
Right.
But you have to. Otherwise, that's not leadership to me.
Right. And it's really, you know, impressive to, like, think about all of these different organizational as well as, like, business priorities that you've implemented at Westbourne, because, you know, a restaurant could just be, we serve delicious food, the end. But it's, we serve delicious food. We really take care of our team, the founder included. We think a lot and care about our community and have systems in place for that, not to speak of the planet when we're thinking about sourcing or zero waste. So in addition to, you know, running Westbourne, you are also an investor and you see businesses across the spectrum, restaurants, technology, consumer packaged goods, other retail goods. And so I want to talk a bit about triple bottom line businesses and the fact that, you know, they're increasingly resonating with consumers, triple bottom line being people, planet, profit. So how do you place value on people and planet in addition to profit? Like, you told us what you do, but, like, how does, as a business owner, like, how do you manage all of that all in one?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on if you're asking me as an entrepreneur, as an investor.
Maybe you can speak to both. I don't know.
I mean, as an investor, people are everything. And I always say, you know, there's sort of that VC term, you know, product, founder, market fit. But really, it all comes down to the founder, because at the end of the day, the business plan is going to change. Also, I invest usually at seed round and or Series A. I'm usually a very early investor. Oftentimes, I'm the first check. I love getting in early because I feel that I can see things that don't exist, whereas a lot of investors have a harder time with that. But that means whatever's in your deck is going to change. Like, whatever's happening at Seed Round will be totally different by Series A and Series B and on. So it really doesn't come down, frankly, maybe a little bit on the market and somewhat on the product. But really, is this person destined to do this? And are they the person that's going to take it all the way to touchdown? Because there's going to be tons in their way. There's going to be so many permutations. And at the end of the day, you're really investing in them. They're the only constant. The market's going to evolve. The product's going to change. But it's very hard to get a founder out. And honestly, why invest if you're going to try and get the founder out is sort of my feeling. So for me, in that sense, the person is most important. And if they're, and then I guess what I look at with, you know, a potential company and entrepreneur, and for myself, it's really, are those things, those three things, the triple bottom line, really symbiotic? Like, do they create a win-win-win? Because if one is coming at the expense of the other or doesn't really naturally fit, then it's not really a triple bottom line. You're really greenwashing on one of those pillars. Like, you can say it all you want and you can do it all you want. You know, and without naming names, there are a lot of companies that have done that. Companies that have created foundations in the last 2 years that didn't start that way. Companies that, we were just talking earlier, you know, are promoting women within their organization very unorganically, who actually have no power or authority because they want to be seen as female friendly to be on the cutting edge of, you know, trends. I think that stuff doesn't ever really work in the long run. I think human beings are very intuitive. And I always say people have really high BS radar. They might not be able to explain why. They might not be able to quantify it, but you know when something's off. So for me, people, planet, and profits have to be naturally aligned. So for us, you know, for us, zero waste is important because it allows not only a really efficient operation, but it allows us to, I also think, reach a lot of different audiences. You know, we get a lot of interesting opportunities and partnerships because we're zero waste and we care about sustainability, but we're not just talking the talk and we didn't slap a label on it, you know, 18 months later because it's hot now. Vice versa, I think that, you know, our give back model and partnership with the Robin Hood Foundation is meant to tackle also a big restaurant operation issue, which is talent. How do you hire, keep, and train talent? It's very hard. So if that give back model actually makes sense for what you're doing and actually can help part of your operation, then it really is a triple bottom line.
Awesome. Thank you for explaining that. We are here with Camilla Marcus, businesswoman, investor, founder of Westbourne, friend and advisor of ours. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back in just a minute to talk more about her investor life, tech table, and more. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
Hey there, welcome back to Pineapple Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Satara. We are here with our friend Camilla Marcus, the founder of Westbourne. And we just got into a really great conversation about investing and running your business with a triple bottom line. So we wanted to ask you the question of, you know, you just explained very eloquently how you assess businesses that are doing social enterprises and your own business too. So how do you fit in all of these ideas of people, planet, and profit into your business? What do you look at internally to decide how to negotiate and reconcile all of those elements?
Oh, that's a good one. Ultimately, I mean, I've said this a million times, but it's dead true. I love Phil Knight. Shoe Dog is my Bible. We make everyone read it. And it is for me because, you know, just do it is sort of my MO. You just have to do it. I think when you really believe in something and it is truly core to who you are, to the values of the organization, to the reason that people signed on the dotted line to come work with you, you got to do it. And people are going to poke holes. I always say, like, floods find cracks. That's my biggest thing. It's my biggest piece of management advice. You can't have a crack. Like, if you say you are zero waste, then you can't do things that aren't. And it's all about expectations. So I do think, you know, when we think about our own organization, our three pillars, LA-inspired, mission-driven, and vegetable-forward, is really the filter that we put everything through. And I think because we believe it so deeply and earnestly, even new team members will come on board and say, hey, you know, I noticed this. Have we thought about this other thing? Have we experimented with a new product? I mean, I can't tell you how many times we have team members come in and, like, you know, we'll make something this way. Well, have we thought about this other thing? And, you know, even if we use something as a special for a catering event, for example, we'll have a team member be like, oh, I saw these stems from this. Can we put it in this? Have we thought about this sauce? What if I make a baked good with it? I mean, the amount that you open up, I think, creatively and innovatively within your own team when it's real, when that seed was there day one, I think is honestly infinite. And we don't really have, it just kind of comes organically to be able to filter things through that because our guideposts and our North Star is so clear to all of us. And I think, you know, how do businesses do it? You asked this at the break and I sort of chuckled and just said, look, I think you as the founder or the leader have to really believe it. It has to be something you're really passionate about. You know, I said, like, if you're supporting the ASPCA and then you're serving burgers, like, you got a problem, you know, and someone in your organization is going to raise the BS flag and say, well, how can the right hand do this and the left hand does something else when we're really one team? That doesn't really make sense. So I do think, you know, a lot of people try and sort of retrofit the triple bottom line, and I think that's when it gets problematic. I think when it really starts that way and in whatever you're trying to improve people, planet, or profit-wise, they have to make sense and align, and they have to be symbiotic. Otherwise, it just will unravel from the core.
Yeah, right. Having it as part of the DNA from the get-go is, I think, what it is positioning a lot of startups in a really great way as compared to, you know, industry stalwarts. So as we look at the food industry and, you know, the Unilevers and P&Gs of the world, Procter & Gamble, that is, and all of their portfolio companies, which are, you know, the heritage brands, quote-unquote heritage brands of the supermarket, you know, among our generation, millennials, like, those brands have lost a ton of equity because, you know, no longer is, you know, Clorox or Duncan Hines or any of these brands mean anything good to us. And so, you know, I think that's what's really interesting about startups, especially in the food and hospitality space, is that they're starting with a totally new ethos and a DNA that does, I think, not all, but many, you know, get at this triple bottom line piece. So you've invested in a lot of amazing businesses. Again, you know, The Wing, Great Jones, Cookware, Bento Box, which is a technology platform for restaurants, and then Ramona Wine Cooler, all different points of food and hospitality. So what do you look for in businesses in which to invest? You talked about the founders earlier, but, like, what else?
Yeah. Well, one additional thing, actually, with founders, the number one question I ask is, why are you doing this? You could do anything. You clearly are smart. Anyone who's trying to venture out on their own, you're smart, you're driven, you're capable. You literally could do anything. So why are you spending every waking, breathing minute in like the hardest role you could possibly pick to do this? And you'd actually be amazed at how many people can't answer that question. And I think really tremendous founders, it just flows right from them. And you just know this is the right person for this. And this is what they're meant to be doing right now. And then in addition, you know, I really enjoy being a strategic investor for companies. So to me, it has to be something I want to exist. I don't necessarily have to be the core user, but I do think it has to be something where I think even personally, like, wow, I just want this to exist. And then third is, you know, can I be helpful to them? Am I really someone that can give them advice or connections or, you know, whatever support, even through Westbourne, whatever it is? I think if I'm really just a plain check and not of any use, it's just not that interesting for me. You know, that's just not really why I do it. I do it much more from, you know, it's great returns, but it's more passion for me as far as wanting to help. So, you know, it's interesting. Both Great Jones, actually, and Ramona came out of, actually been looking at those categories for a while. I met with a lot of canned wine companies, and actually every founder I met with, I said, the problem is you're not the right person for this. You're, you know, whatever, a marketing guru, kind of to what we were talking about before with BS Radar. It's like, yeah, you can create a great brand, but like, you're not a beverage person. Like, I don't believe that you love wine, and I don't believe you really know what's in your product. That's not really going to work in the long term, because the game is really sales, and it's those relationships. And someone who is a brand and well-connected and well-informed and organic in that industry is going to leapfrog you in 5 seconds. And then I met Jordan, and I, you know, almost fell off my chair. I was like, this is exactly what I was saying. And really, same with Sierra and Great Jones. I'd been following a lot of the cookware startups, kind of feeling like that's why VC money is struggling in that space, because it is an emerging category. It certainly needs to exist. It's a no-brainer that that should be on everyone's stovetop, but none of those people before them were really food people. Like, they just don't get it. They're not really cooks. They don't know the people who set the market for cooking and home goods. You know, and then Sierra, she wouldn't tell me the concept for a really long time. And then she finally came clean, and I was like, I'm in. And she's like, what? I haven't even sent you the deck. And I said, again, it's sort of the founder I've been looking for this category. So a lot of times that's how it happens. So yeah, it kind of depends, but funny enough, I also, I mean, I shouldn't say this as an investor, and most people get mad when I say it, but I really just have a good gut about it in a really weird way. And to me, you know, people always talk valuation and numbers and the model. And again, the seed level, it's like, all that's made up. Like, you've never even sold a piece. This is a deck. So you know what? I mean, I worked in finance. I know you can change any assumption and the numbers pop out whatever you want it to pop out. And I used to say that at my PE fund all the time and, you know, get booed out of the room, but it's true. When you invest in real estate, you have a feeling about the market, you have a feeling about the neighborhood, and you feel that that asset is largely within value. You don't want to overpay because you'll never make a return, but ultimately, I can get the model to say, what, you know, there would always be these, well, make this lower, make that a 2, make that a 5. I'm like, cool, but I'm just making it up. And you want it to say something for our, you know, our fund investors, and I get that, but ultimately, do we believe in this market and do we think this business makes sense? Great. That's all you really need. You know, within, again, you kind of have your sort of larger markers, but this obsession with sort of, you know, KPIs and IRR and all these like financy terms that everyone throws out, you know, when it's a deck is laughable. Like, there isn't actually any real numbers yet. Like, talk to me at Series A. Yeah, then I think those things start to really come into play. But like, you know, people are like, what KPIs do you look for? I'm like, none of your KPIs are real. Right. It's great. I believe in you, but like, these are all made up. I've done Excel monkey work before. Like, let me tell you, you can make it say whatever you want, but that's not really the foundation. So I think for me too, you know, I do have the finance background to be able to sort of do the back of the envelope and get those sort of benchmarks in place, but it's ultimately a gut of that founder product market fit. And do I think I'm a good fit for them too? Like,
right.
I'm an acquired taste as an investor. Anyone will tell you, anyone who's sat down getting business advice from me, I'm candid, I'm unfiltered, I'm not here to sort of, you know, coddle you. To me, it's not helpful, but that is certainly not for everyone. And I have definitely scared off some businesses.
Well, I think that's really good advice for anyone who is, you know, starting up their business and looking at their deck. And, you know, really it comes down to the concept and taking a bet on the person if they're the right fit. So I think that's great advice. We honestly could have an entire podcast to talk to you about this. We didn't get to talk about TechTable, but for our audience who doesn't know it, can you explain a little bit about TechTable and how you got involved and what it is?
Yeah, so I started it with my co-founders. This is actually going to be the fifth TechTable Summit. So it's essentially a platform and thought leadership for hospitality technology. So we bring together investors, tech entrepreneurs, and hospitality leaders, essentially to foster collaboration in an industry that's funneling billions of dollars. I mean, if anyone's ever worked in a hotel or restaurant, it used to be so analog, so paper and pencil, still kind of is, which kills me. And, you know, seeing that there's just huge opportunity for technology to smooth these operations, to help support, you know, the human touch. So our tagline's high tech for high touch. We're techtablesummit.com. Our next summit's going to be October 29th in New York. We essentially gather 225 people, rooms pretty evenly split between investors in the space, as I said, tech entrepreneurs, and that's both sort of startups as well as incumbents, and then hospitality leaders. So we have usually a little bit of hotel representation, some airline representation, and then food companies. So whether that's fast casual or fine dining, all across the country, some international. And the idea is really, you know, if the left hand, again, isn't talking to the right hand, which was happening 5 years ago. I mean, no tech companies really knew any hospitality companies. And yet they're like, well, we have this great solution that you want. And they're like, well, I've never met you and you've never worked in a restaurant. So really, your solution's not that good. And so there ended up being a lot of sort of friction and antagonism rather than really working together. And that capital can be used so much better if there is actually this cross-pollination and collaboration. So it's been pretty exciting. Can't believe it's been 5 years.
Congrats. That's
It seems like a really great example of like so many of the talents that you bring to the table and the interests. And
certainly helps start Westbourne because our systems are
totally
pretty unique. You know, we use a lot of West Coast platforms, which most East Coast companies don't. So being able, you know, selfishly for myself and our business, to really have a window into all the innovation that's happening and sort of where the ball's moving is such an advantage that, you know, especially if you're dealing with legacy products or you aren't that informed, you don't have time to make those decisions diligently. I mean, those tech platforms can sort of make or break your operation. It's high risk.
Yeah. So speaking of make or break, this is our last full question, but want to end it on a note of opportunity and giving our audience food for thought in terms of the food industry. So the question is, you know, we see tons of opportunity in the food industry to innovate here at Pineapple. I'm sure you do see it all the time. Yeah. What are those opportunities and what advice do you have for people to seize them?
I think there's a few things. It's first of all I think about all day long. And then my team is like, okay, one thing at a time, you know, write it down, put it somewhere. Thank you so much. I'll sort of go what I consider inside out, which is sort of at the source and then sort of where we are with end, you know, guests and consumers. Our food system has to change. We, you know, for anyone who's not read Third Plate, it is the Bible. You must. I mean, we cannot continue. We have to unravel the Industrial Revolution is essentially what is happening. And we have to for both our planet and for food quality. And, you know, I think those conversations are starting, but I think there's huge, huge room to really transform agriculture. I mean, when we were at Seilu, the conversation was really, I mean, people always say to me, man, your job's hard. I'm like, look, the people who grow our food, they're the heroes. It is such a hard job. They are working against such a big food tide. And, you know, we're sitting in DC. One day I'm going to hire myself a really powerful lobbyist because I got a lot that I want to change and it has to happen here. You know, it's a real uphill battle. So I think one is really the food system and getting sustainable, you know, real sustainable farming to be accessible and sort of the norm rather than what we have right now is one. Two, packaging. I mean, again, I will do anything to support anyone who can help transform the, really the stronghold that we have in the plastics industry. I mean, again, everything comes down to incentives. It's always public-private pressure that leads to real solutions, frankly. I was actually just on an amazing podcast with Harper's Bazaar with the head of the UN General Assembly, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, we at Westbourne, from day one, all of our packaging, including straws, if I had to hear that word one more time, I'm going to die, are 100% compostable. But you know what? We pay a premium for it, and it took us a really long time to source it all, and we source from multiple places, and it's complicated. Right. You know, most people aren't committed to that, and most people aren't willing to figure out how do you make that surcharge work, when really, you know, why aren't we saying to the plastics industry, you know what, you got 2 years to make it all compostable, and it has to be the same price. Right. Done. How come every major city does not require recycling and composting? That needs to change. And then I think on the end is, truly, when it comes to hospitality and restaurants, one, we have to start organizing. We are the second largest employers in the country. We are also, in my opinion, the last frontier to a real thriving middle class. It's very few jobs where you do not need a certain education or experience, and you can have a real career that is ultimately a six-figure career. There are endless restaurants in every single city. That employment potential is huge. That career potential is huge. And yet we are constantly bearing the brunt of regulation from government. We are not supported. We are not well represented, and we are not well organized. And that is going to become, I think, a huge problem in the next decade or two. And that change must happen. We are totally picked off because we are disaggregated. I think we're a very collaborative and connected community. But because the operations are so difficult, I think it's so hard for people to lift their head out of the water and go, you know what, I get it. Running these restaurants and running these hotels are difficult, but we're not going to last, and we're not going to survive in the way that we should. I don't dream of everything being fast casual. I mean, that would make me very sad, and I don't think that's the future of food. I do think having diversity and, you know, authentic voices and choices when it comes to dining out and being taken care of. But that will only exist if we start pushing back and saying, you know what, instead of banning straws in restaurants, let's tell manufacturers that they have to make strawless tops from now on, and let's make them cost parity. How mm-hmm. about that? Mm-hmm. You know, like, let's regulate at the source. But they regulate on us because we don't have as big of a voice. Right. And that really has to change.
Well, I literally have goosebumps right now. I thought when we asked you
I got
that
a big
question, no, it's so inspiring. And even just to see the way that you've organized that answer into really big ideas where we really need to work to see the change that we
want to see. If anyone knows a lobbyist that wants to work with me, send me an email.
Yeah. No, it's really inspiring to be here with you. And, you know, from hearing your story about growing up around food to how you, you know, founded Westbourne, your investments and all of your business advice, including how we need to change our system, is very inspiring for us. We do not have a lot more time, but we want to do a very quick rapid fire question round with you, Camilla. So for your first question, please tell us a woman you pine for in food.
Oh my gosh, there's too many to name. There's too many to name. And I get asked that all the time, but I have to tell you, I am the luckiest. I have the most incredible village of talented women in this business. I would not be where I am, who I am, and so feeling at home in this business without each and every one of them, you two included. So really, every one of them knows who they are, and I can never pick one because every single one is mission critical, and I just couldn't survive without them.
I think go to your Pine 4 Pantry feature on our website.
There's a great
list
there.
How many
there.
Pages are there?
Right.
There's not enough.
And you can get the full deal. Our next question, your go-to pantry and fridge item. So two items.
Oh, I mean, my pantry item is always, I mean, I put olive oil on everything. I'll put it on dessert. I cook with it. I probably use really way too nice of olive oil to cook with, but I put it on everything. I mean, I would bathe in it. I would keep it in my pocket and drizzle it on everything. In our fridge, probably hot sauce. I'm like very obsessed. And chili oil. We make an amazing chili oil at Westbourne, which we're now bottling. I love Cholula. I love to collect hot sauce from everywhere. Again, culturally, I feel like every culture has their version of hot sauce, and it's so unique to have one condiment have such endless expressions just like boggles my mind. And again, maybe not dessert, although I kind of like a hint of spicy in desserts. I'm a very sweet, savory kind of mashup gal, but...
Same.
Yeah, that's probably hot sauces galore.
Awesome. Your all-time favorite restaurant?
Oh, gosh. Also impossible. I can do this one because, you know, it's a relic of the past, sadly, now. My first restaurant job was Dell'Anima in the West Village on 8th and Jane. They've since reopened an iteration in Midtown, but that original place, that was my first restaurant family. I'm still very close with, funny enough, a lot of the women that I met there when I was 22, and the owner, August, is really, really been sort of a guardian angel for me and someone who, you know, he was the first person to walk through the door at Westbourne when we opened. I went to Dell'Anima at 1 a.m. for dinner after that first night of first day of service, and it really was my home, and I cried through the entire last meal, and the chef Andrew was like, please leave, you're driving me crazy, you psycho. And I'm not even a crier, really not. So Dell'Anima will always just, it has just a really big piece of my heart.
Beautiful. Your favorite farmer's market?
Ooh, probably the Hollywood Farmers Market in LA, maybe Santa Monica close second. And then, I mean, I guess I have to say Union Square third, but it's just when you go to California and you see those farmers markets, it's just like, it's unbelievable. And those stands have been there forever. And it's just so beyond bountiful. It's like what I dream about. I was telling them sort of off line that whenever I see Instagram posts from my friends in LA who cook, I'm like, damn you, stop posting this. I hate you. It's so unfair. but Union Square, too. I mean, for us, it's really cool to see a lot of our vendors there and to get to see them in person. And again, I think that's really, you know, I'm really not religious, but like that's God's work. I mean, really growing and raising the food that we get to consume and that I think most people, unfortunately, really take for granted, I think is like just the greatest privilege and something so special. But probably have to say Hollywood. I might get in trouble for that.
Good answers, I should say. Last question is, where can our audience find you, both IRL and digitally?
Ooh, IRL, I don't know. Probably mostly at the restaurant, walking around my neighborhood, or on the road. I don't know. I'm always probably hard to pin down IRL. Like I told you, I hate routine. So people are always like, oh, when are you in the restaurant? I'm like, if I have a set schedule, I will jump off the roof. I can't deal with that. So... and digitally, I guess my Instagram is @_CamillaRuth_@Westbourne. You can send me an email, Camilla@Westbourne.com, anytime you want to chat.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us, Camilla.
Awesome.
This was a dream for us.
Yeah. Ditto. I was looking forward to this all month while I was away.
Yes. And we can't wait to continue showing you around DC and coming back to Westbourne on our next New York trip.
Thank you guys so much.
And you can find us at Pineapple Collaborative on Instagram, pineapplecollaborative.com. If you have any questions about this episode or about Pineapple in general, feel free to hit us up. You can email us hello@pineapplecollaborative.com, slide into our DMs, all Ooh. Of the above.
Or leave us a review if you like this show. We'll read it on the air if you leave it for us and it's a good one.
Only if it's nice.
Only if it's nice, exactly. Yeah.
All right, that's it for today.
Catch you next time.